Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, September 28th, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, political analysis, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. Join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hello, Abe.
Hello, John.
And back from the disabled list, Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
So, Noah, you are almost fully healed from your terrible infirmity.
Yeah, it got worse before it got better. But it is pretty much good. There's some sort of like a silver cream that you put on it, and it's a miracle. It's just a little raw now, but it's almost entirely healed, and
gotta,
I will be
gotta watch out for that popcorn.
Making popcorn again. Oil. I'm going back into it.
You got to. You got to get back on the popcorn horse. Very
important. I
think
I can master it now.
Very important. Abe, you got no injuries?
That's why I don't cook.
There we go. That's it.
That's
you could get killed in there.
If it weren't for the risks.
You could get killed in there.
That's why I do. In there. HelloFresh.
Ah, and you know what? HelloFresh isn't even there. We just got HelloFresh. Just got a free, got a free commercial, and I don't know how I feel about that actually. But we will mention that to our friend Fred, who helps us with the ads, and maybe he'll tell HelloFresh that that we just happened to mention them. So, guys, Tuesday night, of course, Alabama Senate primary runoff in the Republican Party saw Big Luther Strange, the appointed senator, fall to Judge Roy Moore. Judge Roy Bean, of course, being the frontier judge of Langtree, Texas, subject of a really bad movie with Paul Newman in 1972, but we'll move on from there. Judge Roy Moore, of who famously used state funds to build a monument to the Ten Commandments and place it on the lawn in front of the state courthouse, ordered removed by a federal judge, and Moore refused to do so. That was his first real moment in the national spotlight, then followed by all manner of quite horrifying comments about how we deserve 9/11 because we're sinful and a lot of other stuff. So Roy Moore will likely be the senator from Alabama after a runoff against a Democrat who people seem to think, named Doug Jones, who people seem to think might have an outside shot at winning, but I find that dubious given the fact that he, what may be the most culturally conservative state in the union, just basically supported abortion on demand until birth. It seems to me that it's going to be very hard for a guy like that to prevail even against a professional provocateur whose statements seem to mark him as being outside the pale. Anyway, so the real issue here is not only there's a lot of argle bargle about whether this hurts Trump because Trump endorsed Strange and he sent out some tweets endorsing Strange and he appeared at a rally for Strange. Of course, at the rally for Strange, he said, maybe I made a mistake endorsing him, so I'm not so sure that it will hurt him. And since the debate between Strange and Moore all revolved around who would be more Trumpian than the other, I'm not sure that this can be viewed in any way, shape, or form as a rejection of Trump and not simply Trump voters saying that they wanted a guy who struck them as being even more in Trump's mold than Trump is. So to me, that's not the interesting thing about this race. The interesting thing about this race is what it portends for 2018 and the Republican Party and the Republican majority in the Senate and what will happen there. Noah, so let's unpack this. Why don't we start with Roy Moore wins in December and is sworn in as a senator, let's say, speculating, of the United States Senate. What happens then?
Well, first, I want to go back a little bit and say that your dismissal of the nature of the endorsements, sort of non-endorsements, what happens here, what the voters thought and care about, is not only not interesting, I think it's absolutely fascinating and portends a really interesting development in the direction of MAGA.
How so?
Which I wrote about.
Yes,
so,
you did, but how? But lay it out.
So, yes, Trump sort of half-heartedly endorsed Luther Strange on the, you know, advice of people around him and who were getting that advice from Mitch McConnell. So Luther Strange's loss is, yes, it's a blow to Mitch McConnell and sort of tangentially a blow to Donald Trump, although Trump was only half committed to it. About a month prior, on August 13th, or 16th rather, when they had the actual primary, this was a runoff. They had a primary on the 16th in which the candidate of the conservative right, endorsed by the likes of Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, Laura Ingraham, and Ann Coulter, Representative Mo Brooks, who was a Tea Party conservative elected in 2010, member of the Freedom Caucus, all-around anti-establishmentarian guy, campaigned against Mitch McConnell as hard as he did against Luther Strange. He came in third place. So everybody here
didn't like Trump.
I wasn't a big fan of Trump. He was, in fact, that was one of the big reasons why he lost so badly, is because he came out against Trump after the Access Hollywood tape, among many others, as, you know, a moral majoritarian kind of position. So, what's the takeaway here? In my opinion, it's that the voters in Alabama are onto the game. They knew what Trumpism was to them, which is an affectation, a prickly sort of approach, peeving off the right people. Taking positions that will frustrate and annoy those in effete parlors on the coasts. And it doesn't really matter what anybody says about it. They understand what the position is, what Trumpism means to them. And if that means going against Trump, they're happy to do it because they think that's what he really sort of wants. Now, it might be right here, but a couple of months down the road, a year down the road, maybe Trump becomes the obstacle to Trumpism. Maybe Trump isn't Trump enough for Trump.
Here's why. I mean, I think that is a possibility, but here's why I don't think it's likely, and why ultimately it's not as interesting a question as it could be, because Trump will never be out-Trumped again. He's not going to stand in the way of this wave.
I don't think that's true at all. We have right now, we're in the middle of Trump out being out-Trumped. Because Trump is deferring again to the Republican majority in Congress. It's whatever they want.
Wait, on the tax bill? Okay, but let's
we're getting ahead of ourselves.
No, but I want to let's try to sort through this. So Noah's point is that Trumpism is a is not a philosophy, is not even a cult of personality. It's a penumbra, an emanation of nihilist populism that says everything in Washington is terrible and every incumbent is bad and every establishment is wrong and throw the bums out and Luther Strange.
It's identifiable not in the behavior of somebody who is Trumpian, but in the reaction of people who aren't Trumpian to that figure. If he's sufficiently annoying to people who aren't Trumpian, he's Trumpian.
So what you're saying is it's that thing of, you know, I love their agony. So as long as they're going crazy, that means I've done something right. Okay. We're not really saying anything. These are just two sides of the same coin. But I think in general what we have here is this idea that voting for Roy Moore is not a vote against Trump in any way. I don't think anybody thinks that voting for Roy Moore is a vote against Trump in any way. Even if Trump said that he endorsed
Big Luther,
you have to understand now. Now I think we need to. What I think Abe is saying is that Trump is not going to be the Pelosi Schumer Trump of the last couple of weeks. That he did that. He's going to let it go. He's not going to let himself get crosswise of his own populist anti-Washington rep.
Yeah, or even if he does, I don't even know to what extent that hurt him among the populists. But he's not. What he's not going to do is he's not going to oppose populists again. He's not going to get on board with the so-called establishment.
I know, but that's the joke again. Of this is I'm sure that Luther Strange is probably the most right-wing person in the history. It would have been the most right-wing person in the history of the Senate anyway. So the question is, what does it mean when he's rejected? Well, there are state-specific reasons he was rejected, right? That he was appointed by this governor who was then ousted. There's some sort of, looks like it was a sweetheart deal. That came out the week before the election. In the end, by the way, Moore did not win by any larger than he won the runoff. And he won by 9.2 points or something like that. And, you know, it looked like some of the final polling, though the poll aggregate came very close. There was a couple polls had him up 15, had Moore up 15 or 16 points. So the idea that, you know, strange that Moore ran away with this is just simply is not true. But I think the whole point is Trump and Alabama, Mitch McConnell needed to back Strange to the hilt. Not because he needed Strange, not because he didn't want Moore, though I'm sure he's terrified at the prospect of having Moore in the caucus, but because he needed to send a signal that the Republican Party in the Trump era in 2017 would back incumbents when they ran for office against insurgents. That if he is not in a position where he can tell the Republican senatorial caucus that they need not, that the President of the United States and his people will back the conventional incumbent candidates for office. He doesn't want Bob Corker of Tennessee, who quit the day that the Moore Strange runoff took place, said he wasn't going to run. He didn't quit the Senate. He said he wasn't going to run for re-election. He's got Roger Wicker in Mississippi. He's got Jeff Flake in Arizona. You know, if they lose Flake, if there are primaries, which Flake loses to Kelly Ward, Wicker, it's unlikely that a Democrat can win Mississippi, but Wicker loses to this guy McDaniel. Corker doesn't run for re-election and a guy named Mark Green wins there. Democrats only need a 3-seat pickup to take the Senate. Now, it's very unlikely it'll happen. Democrats have a lot to defend. Republicans don't have much to defend at all. This is a bad year structurally for Democrats in the Senate coming up in 2018. But I think it's not just the Senate here. I think this is a genuine anti-incumbent wave, emotional wave against incumbents in the Republican Party as the Republican Party is in a position of governance. That's the bizarre aspect of this, is this notion that you primary and destroy your party. You know, you primary and try to knock out, you know, establishmentarian figures while you're running things.
Well, I think that's these two things are hard to divorce. The fact that we've had an utter abject failure of governance on the part of the Republican Party, and the fact that you have this insurgent sort of sentiment that's catalyzed by the president, even though he's not really on board with it, because Trump is informed reliably and I think convincingly that he needs some sort of a legislative achievement in order to have a successful presidency, and he's inclined to support whatever Republicans in Congress want to do. Their objectives are obviously to reform the tax code and to pass something that can plausibly be called repeal and replace. And he doesn't care what that amounts to. And so he'll support whatever candidates the Senate Majority Fund or whatever McConnell's PAC is are willing to back, because that's the objective. It's not just that he's a populist and he's got this populist image and the support of the populist masses, who he can probably count on and take for granted. He also needs an achievement. And if they had an achievement, by the way, they would be tethered to something concrete. But there's nothing there to keep this coalition together, so they're just directionless.
The idea that Mitch McConnell is to blame for the loss of health care is comic to me. I mean, and what's more, I think Trump is doing it, and Trump is blaming McConnell. Obviously, McConnell said, you know, like being the Senate Majority Leader is like herding cats. There's nothing McConnell can do to force Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski or John McCain to vote for a bill they don't want to vote for. He doesn't have any enforcement power. A lot of that was taken away from the Senate Majority Leader and the House leaders by changes in rules that meant that there were no more earmarks and things like that. It's very hard He doesn't have any enforcement power. He is a manager of legislation. He is a controller of the calendar. He can, you know, sort of put things before the Senate. And this idea that has now broad across the land that Mitch McConnell is a bad Senate majority leader is, it seems to me, insane. It's not his doing. He has done what it was in his power to do. He's not a, you know, he's not a rhetorician. He's not a powerful presence. But, you know, he is a very stolid person to the extent that he sat there and took unbelievable amounts of fire for refusing to put Merrick Garland up for a hearing throughout 2016 and basically made possible the appointment and confirmation of Neil Gorsuch. That was him and him alone. Many, many, many other people in that position would have crumbled under the pressure. And I'm not even saying, by the way, I'm not taking a value judgment line on whether or not Garland was treated fairly or unfairly. My point is that he stood there, took the flak, took the fire, and, you know, now I think Trump is affirmatively going to turn on him. I think it's likely that Trump will turn on him. And he provided Trump with the only victory Trump has had so far that's of any enduring meaning.
Right, yeah, I was going to say, I don't think Trump is at all above pressuring Mitch McConnell on legislation while defying him on maintaining the establishment. I think Trump is perfectly capable of doing that, and effectively, weirdly, you know, but he'll do it. But I just want to add, there's another point here that I think is important, which is that up until this point, there was this question that there was nothing sort of too ugly for Trump fans. There was nothing so ugly that Trump fans would sort of reject Trumpism in Trump. Moore's victory is an indication that that's not attached to Trump. Because Trump had said, you know, I could shoot a man in the middle of Fifth Avenue and they still love him. It may be true, maybe not true. I don't know.
That's true.
Roy Moore, as John was saying, has said, you know, has issued a host of hideous statements having to do with birtherism, having to do with sort of paranoia about Sharia, having to do with our deserving 9/11 and all the rest of it. Trump opposed him. Trump did not endorse him, as we were saying. I mean, he half-heartedly endorsed Luther Strange, fine. Roy Moore still won. It's not that Trump can be the emblem of any ugliness and can get away with it. This is a sort of a movement sense.
That's my point precisely, is that MAGA is a runaway train. The creators of this thing, the radio hosts, the populist nihilists on the internet, even Donald Trump himself, no longer have control of this thing. They're pretending like they don't have a tiger by the tail. But if they let go of it, there's no suggestion in my mind that this thing can't turn on them.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't understand how precisely it turns on Trump, but I will say this, that
you can't envision a way in which Donald Trump becomes so establishmentarian, so married to the idea that he needs Republicans in Congress, even if they lose control of Congress,
that he can become an obstacle? I think it's much more likely that the idea will be that Trump has been taken hostage in some fashion by Jared Kushner and needs to be liberated to be Trump. And that's what Steve Bannon said when he was on stage with Roy Moore. He said, we're not doing this to attack Trump. We're doing this to honor Trump. We're doing this to help Trump. He doesn't understand, there are reasons that he doesn't understand that this would be better for him and for his movement and for everything he stands for than Luther Strange. And that is the way it would have to be phrased and calculated. Now, it may well be that Trump wants people just to do what he tells them to do and will be angry when they don't do what he tells them to do. On the other hand, the person that he should be turning his ire on, from what we hear, is none other than his son-in-law, who apparently was the primary force in the White House pushing him to get actively involved in helping Luther Strange win. And why should he go at his son-in-law? Because his son-in-law knows jack about politics. He has put his son-in-law in this position, this kid who spent $1.8 billion on an office building worth $900 million, somebody who knows nothing from nothing, you know, is a sort of lightweight, and he has invested in him all this power and authority on the basis of nothing. He's not going to do anything in the Middle East. He's not going to do, you know, so far he has been a very little help. He sort of told him to fire Comey, which is inarguably the dumbest thing that he has done in the course of his presidency. At what point is he going to turn on Jared Kushner and say, I can't listen to your advice anymore? Now, he is his son-in-law. Many people don't like their sons-in-law, so that he likes him is very nice. It's not necessarily, it's not an unconditional love, one would presume.
The Trump family needs to tie itself further to another aristocratic family in the country, and Ivanka will agree to a divorce.
or he doesn't need a son-in-law. I don't know. It's just sort of an interesting thing that's like, Jared Kushner says, no, you should do Luther. Okay, I'll do Luther Strange. It's like, what is he listening to him for? I don't understand. I mean, by the way, I think it was, you know, he didn't have to involve himself that much. The interesting question is, as I say, I think people voting for Luther Strange didn't think that they were sticking a finger in Donald Trump's eye. People who voted for Moore didn't think they were sticking a finger in Trump's eye because they figure Moore and Trump are pretty much the same type, right? So Trump may feel that, you know, he was forced to...
Well, they're not actually, though. I mean, they're very different.
No, but they're not different
Donald
in
Trump
that...
Donald Trump has no interest in the Ten Commandments.
Donald Trump is interested in middle finger up to America,
exactly.
and so is Roy.
Exactly. So it's not substance, as we said. It's right. All about affectation.
Right.
And because that is so amorphous and takes so many forms that voters essentially make that decision based upon negative reactions, negative feedback that they get from the rest of the country.
Right. Now, the other question that is raised, as I say, is not just the Senate and the question of whether or not...
And Moore went around, I'm sorry to just interrupt one more time, Moore went very explicitly against Mitch McConnell, against Donald Trump on the health care vote, which is the only reason why he endorsed Luther Strange to begin
with. There was a fantastic memo, and I'm now blanking on the guy's name, and if you remember it, maybe you can look it up because you have your computer here, but there was a guy who was a consultant for Moore who wrote a memo that said that the key to understanding Moore's victory was how negative he was about McConnell. Did you read this thing? This is driving me crazy. I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote it, but he worked for Mo Brooks, and then he worked for Moore, and he wrote the night of the
Stephen
election.
Stephen Law.
No,
right?
Not Stephen Law.
No. Oh, that's the Leadership Fund.
Yeah. No, not Stephen Law.
Okay. Different member.
A political consultant. So he wrote this thing. It was on Medium.
Oh, and I found it. Yeah, okay.
Do you have his name? Anyway, the point is that he
Jordan
said...
Jordan
Gerke? That's it. So Jordan Gerke's memo says 58% or something of Alabamans said that Mitch McConnell endorsement or something made them less likely to vote for Luther Strange. And so Moore just was like, McConnell, 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 McConnell. Now, think about McConnell for a minute. It's one thing to hate Harry Reid, right? Harry Reid's obnoxious and he says terrible things about you and he's a pugilistic. It's one thing to hate, you know, get along to go along type. McConnell is a stolid, boring, unexciting figure. How he has become a net horrible negative to deep conservatives is a fascinating thing. He's not an imaginative politician. He's not a sort of creative politician. But I wouldn't say that he's hostile to conservative ideas, conservative trends, conservative anything. He too, like Trump, would have passed anything that would have been called healthcare reform if he could have come up with a magic formula. That's why he assented to bringing this Graham Cassidy bill up a third time, even though it was like, we got to give it a shot. We'll do anything we can come up with.
This is why the MAGA mentality is, in my opinion, a little volatile and could turn on people like Trump, because you had the story in the New York Times that was touching on stuff like this kind of data, and suggesting that the Republican majority has become, for Republicans in the rank and file, the equivalent of Barack Obama. It is the thing at which its invocation creates a sort of backlash. It, right. it mobilizes Republicans to vote. So Republicans are mobilized only to vote by their antipathy for Republicans. And Donald right. Trump is caught
so
between
we
these
saw
two
this,
things.
We saw this developing after 2010, right? We saw it in 20. This became a big thing in 2011 with the first government shut down. And McConnell was not then majority leader because Republicans didn't have control of the Senate. So a lot of this focused on John Boehner, who was then the House majority, the Speaker of the House. But it was this idea that that because Republicans could not work their will in Washington, that this was because of efforts being made by the leadership to screw the conservative base or the Tea Partiers. And they weren't fighting hard enough. They weren't fighting. They weren't going to war. They weren't this. They weren't that. And this was an interesting perspective because, after all, there really wasn't that much they could do. They could pass something through the House. The Senate would have blocked it. In the miraculous case that the Senate would have passed it in 2011, Obama would have vetoed it. They could say no, but they couldn't say yes. They couldn't get anything they wanted, though they could block a lot of things that they – and they did. And they, in fact, effectively blocked 6 years of Obama or 5 years of Obama presidential actions – simply by virtue of being there, and yet they turned into the enemy. So the question is, why did they turn into the enemy? And now Trump effectively may have won the presidency or won the nomination by harnessing that force, right? Because everybody else was the establishment but him, including Rand Paul, including Ted Cruz, including people who were not establishment, including Marco Rubio, who, remember, was the first successful Tea Party candidate. Marco Rubio started running against Charlie Crist in the Republican primary. He was at 3% in the polls. 3%. He was the outlier Tea Party guy, lunatic in Florida, and then he won the Senate. And he becomes Mr. Establishment by 2016. So Trump wins by being not them. And he can still be not them because he is a counterculture president. But they're the House and the Senate, and they're not able to get anything done, granted, or not much, or mostly it's the Senate. But what does that have to do with McConnell? What does it have to do with this hatred of the leadership? What did the leadership do? Leadership didn't do anything wrong.
Well, God forbid they got an actual legislative achievement to which they would have to defend and rally towards and understand and have some talking points that they could repeat to defend it, like any politically active person does when you're in the majority. Then that would be a real problem for
also,
populists
by the way,
who are right. their really chief objective and their big asset and strength is being just impossible to nail to the wall. Like, there's nothing right. that you can actually say that they defend or believe with any real conviction because it just changes minute to minute.
Anyway, meanwhile, there's McConnell sitting there, right? So he's under attack by them and there's all this. He should be ousted and... By the way, you can't just oust someone. The Senate decides who the Senate Majority Leader is. Republicans and the Senate Republican Senatorial Caucus decide. This is not a matter for public discussion or a vote of the nation or of the Republican Party. This is a thing that the Republicans and the Senate decide, and it's a lousy job. It's a crap job. I don't know who would want it, particularly now. And McConnell is actually very skilled and able at it. But, you know, so Trump, so there's now this idea abroad that McConnell must be ousted or cooed, right? Well, first of all, I don't know who would end up taking his job or who would be better or why they would like him better. But let's say that that were, so there's McConnell getting this attack on the one hand. On the other hand, he is also under ferocious assault by others who say he is not doing enough to say the Republican Party cannot tolerate Roy Moore in the Senate. In fact, McConnell said on election night that he would do whatever he had to do to get Roy Moore elected, and that, you know, Roy Moore is so beyond the bounds, so awful, so racist, so macho, so horrible, that he needs to, you know, that both McConnell and Paul Ryan and everybody should rise up and, you know, go at him. Well... So there's nowhere for a guy like that to turn, right? So he does, you know, it's like he should go off and make $1 billion because what's the point of this? Like where is he left? He's a monster to the right. He's a monster to the left. All he's trying to do is score some victories for the Republican Party.
We are seeing the exodus of the establishment Republicans.
We got one. We got one so far.
Well, there was
a couple of retirements in the House, right? Yeah. We keep hearing this thing about how this is only just the tip of the iceberg, right? A lot of people are going to drop. Way more people are going to drop. I think there is a general feeling that Jeff Flake in Arizona really may not run for re-election in Arizona because his poll numbers are just horrendous, like at 30% approval among Republicans, at like 20% approval in the state in general. And only the fact that the person who's running against him is a monster, an awful monster person named Kelly Ward, just a terrible, despicable person who was like, you know, says terrible. Again, I'm not defending John McCain's behavior on healthcare, but, you know, like attacking him for, you know, being a traitor to the United States is a disgusting thing. Anyway, so maybe a Democrat could win there. Who knows? You know, Flake goes, but he's probably, I imagine if those numbers hold up for the next couple of months, he won't continue going. But the real question then is the House. You really could have this thing where we end up, it's 2019, 20 members of the House retire in Trump-friendly seats because they don't want to be primaried and it looks bad for them. And you really could have this very radicalized Republican majority, probably narrowed, or maybe the Republicans won't be in the majority, but let's say they remain in the majority. You could have this very radicalized Republican, Trumpian Republican right
one which
House.
Has no ideological, you know, foundation and is just purely about being a jerk, and that's your affect.
Well, or let's say they're anti-establishment. So this is always the problem. So then they come to Washington, and then what? You think so? The people who voted them in are going to hate them too in 3 months.
Well, Ted Cruz is about being anti-establishmentarian,
and now he's hate. Now I don't
right,
know,
but he doesn't adopt like the either. Appropriate, you know, bitter sort of cultural chip on your shoulder.
Well, I think he's backed up. I think he would have liked to, but he figured that there isn't that much.
I don't think he's that. I don't think he's just personally not that much of a jerk. I think a lot of these people really are just jerks. I mean, it's generally like something that is abjectly depressing. That
you don't
this
think
is a party
like
that is
Ted
becoming
Cruz
something
is looking
that has no
at the
ideology and is just, yeah, he's a good performer.
No, you think he's not looking at, you know, like the Colin Kaepernick, the kneeling and all that and going, man, I wish I'd done that.
Maybe. He probably could have pulled it off, but he couldn't have pulled it off like Donald Trump can pull it off.
Well, of course, first of all, he's not the president. Second of all, I don't know.
He would do the more in sorrow tone, which is the traditional way in which a politician does this. You know, I sympathize with, I understand, and I feel truly sad for these individuals who feel like their country doesn't treat them in this way. But it is not an appropriate response to what the country has done, blah, blah, blah. And that's how you do that sort of thing. And that's how he would do it, because he's a politician. He's been a politician all his life. What people want, what Republicans want, aren't politicians. They want talk radio callers who have no interest in more in sorrow tone, who are only angry and bitter, and who embody an ethos that rejects compromise and rejects comedy in institutions like the Senate and the House that are built on it.
That's what is so maddening to me, which is, here's what's interesting. So in a policy framework, Roy Moore becomes senator, right? So even though we know that he had no idea what DACA was, since he went on a talk radio show and he didn't know what DACA was.
In the middle of the DACA debate.
Right. He didn't know what DACA was. So Trump wants to pass some version of DACA in exchange for something over the course of the next 6 months. That was what he made the deal with Pelosi and Schumer about, right? So he wants a thing to happen. So where does Roy Moore go? He doesn't even know what DACA is, but I'm sure the minute that he finds out, it's like, he doesn't want these Sharia-loving Mexicans in this country.
Right.
Who are bringing their 9/11, they're summoning their moral rod upon us that means 9/11 is a necessary cleansing fire.
So, but this is great because we have a point at which the rubber will hit the road and we can test this out. We can see how out of Donald Trump's hands MAGA will get. I mean, how will Breitbart respond when Roy Moore opposes DACA?
By the way, this happened to Trump in the House with the first version of the healthcare bill. He was for the first version of the healthcare bill, And it was MAGA that opposed him.
And Breitbart has been sending salvos over Donald Trump's bow about DACA forever, and they don't care.
Right. Yeah.
They're off on it the next day.
Right. Now, of course, this is the other thing we should talk about, which is what I've now been calling the Plato's Cave question about Breitbart. But we will get to that after we discuss. I discuss with Abe Greenwald the Great Courses, one of our advertisers, our advertiser today, because, you know, you're listening to this podcast, which means you're a curious person, I think. You're eager to learn as much as possible. We're that way, too, which is why we know you'll enjoy watching the Great Courses Plus as much as we do. Learn about anything that interests you from some of the world's greatest professors. There's unlimited access to stream and download thousands of different videos on so many topics, history, science, even learn a new language or how to cook. Recently, Abe, you've been watching the Great Courses Plus music series on the 30 greatest orchestral works, and as a student of the piano, Abe, very serious, is taking a lot of piano lessons of late, he will tell us a little bit about Dr. Robert Greenberg's Great Courses on the 30 greatest orchestral works.
So great. We're sitting here, we're discussing, you know, sort of like the dive into ugliness of our politics. If you want to escape into beauty instead, this is your opportunity to do it. Robert Greenberg is extremely enthusiastic about these works, and he gives you a good working vocabulary to sort of better appreciate what all it's all about, what the difference between the Baroque and the classical and the Romantic and 20th century music is, and understanding sort of why specific pieces are great and why they're emblematic of their time and place. It is fantastic. So far he's gotten into a little Beethoven and Mozart and Haydn and Vivaldi. It is great.
You know, just reading this review of a biography of Goethe, the great German writer, that said that, you know, he was one of these people who, when he was young, heard Mozart, and when he was old, heard Beethoven. Of course, Mozart taught Beethoven, and you think about that period of, think about that, like these three geniuses, Goethe in the audience, Mozart, you know, in the 1770, Beethoven in the early 1810s or 18, and just the idea of that cultural ferment and the kind of thing, some of the things you can learn when you do the Great Courses Plus. So we want you to experience it too, just as Abe is. They're giving our listeners a full month of unlimited access to enjoy all of their lectures for free, but you need to sign up with this special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/commentary. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/commentary for your free month today. So, guys, let's talk a little bit about the tax cut proposal that is, or the tax reform, I guess tax reform plan is what we have to call it, because it's, in an odd way, in the end, it's not, it should, it needs to be revenue neutral, as we say, for it to pass as part of this supposed reconciliation method, according to which only 51 votes are needed to pass the bill. So for that to be the case, it has to be revenue neutral. There's no such thing as a revenue neutral tax cut, because, of course, a tax cut always, in the early going, will take more money out of the government coffers than it will put back in. There's a lot of ferment about this classic Democratic claim that it hurts, it's a giveaway to the rich, and it hurts the middle class and all that. So if we just put that to one side and then go to some of the interesting debates that have nothing to do with Democrats, because no Democrat is going to vote for this bill. So it's all intra-Republican, intra-conservative conversation that is going to matter in terms of this bill's passage. Noah, you were looking at this in terms of your own life, and you look at this and you say, it looks like I'm probably going to pay a little more in taxes, right?
Well, that's kind of what I thought.
It's hard to tell,
reading
really.
It, yeah, I honestly have no idea. I'm not a policy wonk when it comes to tax code reform or taxes in general. So I was reading and reviewing the work of those who I believe are, and whom I trust. And I'm not entirely sure one way or the other. The bottom line is that it seems the consensus is that this is not a middle-class tax cut. And as a matter of fact, depending on your circumstances, you might pay a little bit more if you are in the middle class, which is to say between 50,000 income and like 120-something thousand income, which is where I'm at as a homeowner too. So you may, based on what I've been reading, be a little bit more hurt. Whereas on the income side, now we'll get to the corporate side in a bit because I know that's where your interest lies and that's where the meat of this proposal is. But on the rich side, people who are high income earners are not going to feel a hit, which is something that this White House is sort of conflicted about because Donald Trump has been telling anybody who will ask for the last 2 years that he wants a tax hike on high income individuals. In fact, you had Gary Cohen out today saying that this is not a gift to the rich, that this is something that is going to hurt the rich as much as it hurts anybody else, which is just patently not true. So the White House is, it's not just Republicans who are negotiating with themselves, it's White House that's negotiating with the White House over what its messaging is going to be.
Okay, so
for individual rates.
As I read this, and none of us is a tax policy wonk, it's very hard to deal with tax cuts that aren't simply, okay, your taxes are being cut from the 18% bracket to 18 to 15, and so you can actually measure that against your income and say you're going to save, $600 this year as opposed to last year. Because a lot of this is they're going to do this, they're going to increase the standard deduction, but then all itemization is gone, and the state and local income tax deduction will disappear, but that only hurts states that have that only hurts people who live in states that have high income state income taxes or local taxes because, a lot of places don't. And so effectively, people from low tax states are subsidizing people from high tax states, and that's not fair. Da-da-da-da-da. Okay. This is all a sideshow. All of this is about moving deck chairs around and finding a little money to pay for certain types of things because the purpose of this bill is to cut business taxes. It is not about brackets. It is not about the middle class. It is not about anything but cutting business taxes. And I don't think that's a bad thing. In fact, I think it is a sensible thing with federal tax levels where they are now to unleash, there's this whole question about whether or not companies are staying on the sidelines. They got a lot of investment capital they're not using because of a lot of uncertainty and all of that. And if you cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20, as is suggested, the theory is there will be an explosion of creative economic activity because the tax situation here will be favorable compared to other countries. And similarly, if you create this new tax rate for small businesses, a pass-through tax rate, as it's called, you will similarly give small businesses an incentive to hire, an incentive to invest, all of that. The problem is that they promise tax because people hear tax cuts and they want the tax cut. And there are two major problems with that, one of which is the federal income tax level for somebody in the lower middle class, let's say, who deserves a tax cut, is actually very low. And even if you cut it by a lot of money, by a lot of percentage numbers, the amount of actual dollars that are going to be saved are relatively small. So if that's the case, then, I had an exchange with somebody about this who was a tax wonk and who said, look, somebody who makes 20, this is not a middle class tax cut, but a single person who makes $20,000 a year, right? Will save $6 according to the plan. So that's like, that's a joke. That's ridiculous, right? Well, that person probably pays in federal income taxes around $200 a year. So that $6 is effectively a 3% tax cut. Now, that's not a big tax cut, 3%. I mean, it's not a great tax cut. But he only pays $200 now because over the last 35 years, the actual taxes that most Americans pay in income tax, federal income tax, has been going down, not up. And so, you know, there's not that much you can do for them. And then in the middle class, the only real way to cut taxes in a way that would help people in this way would be to cut payroll taxes, which take up 14% of your take up 14% every week. But of course, that would endanger Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and no one is ever going to touch those. That's 14% off the top, period. You know, there's no salvation from that, and that's everybody pays that.
Now, this relates to the first half of our discussion, because the idea of unleashing businesses by cutting their taxes is, of course, a standard conservative economic approach. But in the eyes of populists, it's giving fat cats a break, especially if you're not providing substantive breaks for middle class and individuals lower down.
Right.
Well, nobody's explaining this. I mean, it took you 90 seconds to explain that. You had to know a little bit of math. You had to know proportionality and percentages. Nobody's explaining it like this because they're terrified of their own message. It's just it's the healthcare bill all over again. Republicans can't sell their own proposal that they need to flatten the code, broaden, lower the rates, broaden the base. That's what everybody talks about. That's what they always want to do. And nobody can sell it honestly because they're afraid of being demagogued to death.
Right. Now, there are proposals in here that are good economics without question that are terrible optically. For example, this bill eliminates the alternative minimum tax. Most people who understand the existence of the alternative minimum tax believe that it is something that is sorely in need of radical reform. It was instituted in the late 1960s, when it was discovered that some very wealthy people were paying no federal income taxes because they were able to game the system. So the idea was there are people who would be captured by the alternative minimum tax system, which is a flat tax of 26%, no deductions, basta, right? So, which sounds low, but it's actually quite high because you can't write off anything against it. And that over time, tens of millions of people are now captured by the alternative minimum tax system because they take too much in and independent income that isn't taxed in the first place. And there's mysterious how it happens, and that it is really an unjust, it can hammer somebody and make them pay an enormous amount of money in taxes that they didn't mean, you know, that they shouldn't have to pay because they, you know, like they bought a house, they have a big mortgage, and then suddenly they can't deduct their mortgage. They have a flat 26% they have to pay, like that. Okay. So, but it looks bad because, of course, if you're Donald Trump in 2005, you paid $31 million in federal taxes because of the AMT. That thing that someone leaked, you remember the famous leak with the envelope that was sent to the New York Times and then they printed his tax bill and it turned out that he paid $31 million in taxes. So it was like, Trump actually did pay a lot of taxes. This notion that he didn't pay any taxes wasn't true, but it was wholly because of the AMT. So it looks bad to eliminate the AMT, even though people who know this, including people on the left, know the AMT is kind of an unfair and crummy deal.
Although regarding the optics, before that was leaked to the Times, there was all this talk about how Trump, this was all still during the campaign, how Trump might not have paid any taxes for X number of
years.
For 20 years. Right, right.
Because he lost $1 billion and could amortize that loss against his earnings over 20 years, according to tax law.
And that was trying to be used against him. And he said on stage, I forget against whom, if I didn't pay taxes for a number of years, that's because I'm smart. And the crowd ate it up. They liked that.
Right. But I'm just saying, so it looks bad. All these things look bad. The business tax cut looks bad. Even though, you know, cutting taxes to business doesn't mean you're cutting taxes to rich people.
Right.
It means you're cutting taxes on corporate earnings. And the idea is if you give corporations don't spend, you know, don't like take money and blow it at the track. Like corporations will reinvest and spend and grow and build plants and hire people and all of that. I wonder where this is going to go. It's very mysterious. And of course, there are things that are in this bill that may be there to be negotiated out. For example, you might have a lifting of the AMT that is removed. For example, in negotiations, you put it in. so that you can remove it, you know, like a classic negotiating gambit. Or there will be a big tax increase for the rich, but they're reserving it for second stage negotiations, right? Because though the top tax bracket was reduced from 39 to 35%, there is still room, supposedly, for a fourth fourth tax bracket that is not described, in which case you could say impose a 42% tax, for example, on people who make $500,000 or more.
What fascinates me is that we haven't heard anybody talk about what I believed was the objective here, which was to flatten the rates for corporations and get rid of all these loopholes that allow corporations in this country to pay almost no tax or literally zero tax. That was the objective. That was something that left and right can agree on. That's a populist idea. And yet nobody seems to be talking about it as though it's something that's taboo or that it's dangerous.
The idea is that you want to put the sensible economic idea that has terrible optics is you want to bring the tax rate on corporations in the United States in line with other countries, and so that it is not unnaturally high, and so that our economic activity is bolstered so that it's worth it not to build a plant in Mexico, but to build it here. Or it's worth it not to build a plant in China, but to build it here. That's the theory. It's not just about expensing. It's about what happens when these things are made. As I understand it, and if I've said something stupid or illiterate, which I may just have, you can correct me. But I mean, basically, that is the idea, is to harmonize tax rates so that the United States is not uncompetitive in the global taxation market or the global whatever market. So, but it just doesn't look good. So the question is, are they going to bite the bullet to do something that doesn't look good because the return is going to be so crazily well? Because right now we just got a GDP number for the second quarter, 3.1%. If Trump can hold, if economic growth during the Trump era is at 3%, he'll be elected president until 2200. I mean, you know, we haven't had 3%. We haven't had steady 3% growth for, I don't know what, for 20 years. More than 20 years. I think it's 20 years. And if we can do this under these conditions, maybe it can grow faster. And this is the salvation of the Republicans no matter what happens, including the Tea Party, including the MAGA, including everybody. If the United States has an economic boom under Trump, this will benefit Republicans disproportionately. That's just a simple fact of the matter. The party in power will be given credit and the party that's out will not, and that's life.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens to all the analysis. See, during the Obama years, there was all this, you know, well, this is the new normal. We're not going to get above, you know, 2 point whatever. And it was a sort of way of saying, of sort of tampering expectations on Obama, you know, sort of pushing him as, you know, doing an okay job. Now what if we break out of that, you know, for an extended period of time?
But I mean, that's the argument that basically Trump and the Republicans are going to make,
right,
which is do this because this is the bet. This is the bet. The truth is we can't get much benefit out of cutting personal income taxes. There isn't that much to be gotten, but there's an enormous amount to be gotten from this. It just looks bad. It just looks bad. So, and the healthcare stuff, of course, looked bad, and that was enough to you know, torpedo that. So it's an interesting thing. But if this goes down, if the tax cut goes down after the healthcare bill went down, I don't know what I, you know, that's some bad juju. That's all I can say. That's some bad juju. So, on November 7th, here in New York, the commentary roast of Jonah Goldberg, featuring roasters Rich Lowry, Brett Baer, Steve Hayes, Rob Long. Join us. Go to commentarymagazine.com/tickets to see how you can buy your way into this once-in-a-lifetime event. It will be funny. It will be catchy. It will be memorable. You'll get a mug at the end with Jonah's punim on it. Give it a shot. Commentarymagazine.com/tickets. So, for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I am John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.